I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We have a specific holiday for them. Our American flag and yellow ribbons remind us to support them. And yet, less than 1% of the U.S. population is one. Today, we're talking about those who serve in the armed forces and what it means to have such a small portion of our citizens included in those ranks. But first, some people dismiss Kansas as a flyover state. We'll meet two women, though, who want to help dispel this notion. They've spent a year visiting every state park in Kansas, and they're going to tell us what prompted the trips and what they learned in the process. We'll wrap with the latest State House Blend Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. I don't know what's on your bucket list, but visiting all 26 state parks in Kansas probably isn't on it. But it was for a pair of sisters-in-law who today say the experience was pretty dang cool. They have lived to survive their journey, and they are here in the studio to tell us about it. Mary Gage is from Lawrence, and Mary, nice to have you.
Hello.
Welcome. Monica Rembold has lived all over the world, including Hawaii, and now lives near Perry Lake, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Monica, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well, this first question may be utterly predictable here. So, like, why? Why did you guys do
okay.
this?
Yeah. So we both grew up in Kansas, and I have written for Kansas Magazine for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And even so, there were so many places in the state that we had never visited. And we realized this when we were walking one day, because we like to do a lot of long walks.
Right.
And Monica is a horseback rider, and she had been to these state parks. And I said, you know, I don't even know where the state parks are in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of got me thinking that it might be a fun idea to visit all of them. And then I was kind of surprised to know that there were 26.
Yes.
And just where they all were. And
I don't know where they are either.
Actually, probably almost half of them are in the eastern part of the state, which is nice for all of us around this area, because we can get there without going too far. But there's another dozen or so in central Kansas, and then out in western Kansas, we've got about five more.
Mm-hmm.
So they're spread across the state, and some of them are really easy to get to.
Well, Monica, did your sister-in-law drag you along on this journey, or did you go willingly here?
Oh, I went pretty willingly. I mean, she presented the idea to me, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm totally in on that.
Why?
I mean,
why'd you want to see all 26 Kansas state parks?
Because, well, for one thing, I love Kansas, and I think that Kansas, in fact, I think every state has some, every state is beautiful in some way.
Sure.
So I wanted to see all the beautiful things that our state had to offer and just travel, I think, you know, just see what there was. And
she was a great partner in crime for this.
Mary, I think you've described these places as having something of a subtle beauty. Describe
Absolutely.
That to us. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think that's something that can be said about Kansas in general.
Mm-hmm.
Is it's not a knock you out of the ballpark, you know.
Grand Canyon type
experience. But, you know, it is a beauty that grows on you and you learn to appreciate. And the more you see it and take the time to just look around and take in your surroundings, the more amazed at it that you are. And then there are some places that are pretty stunning in this state.
And so, we'll get to those. You know, Monica, I think you've described the state as having a stark beauty. Why do you use that term?
Well, because I think a lot of people, that's what they think about when they think of Kansas, is they get out there in western Kansas and that's all that they know about it. Like, that's maybe the nation's view of what we have is just flat and out there. But it is kind of just stark. And then it's just so shocking once you really dig into the state and you start finding all these just, beautiful things there or things that you wouldn't, like Rock City and Monument Rock and all these little lakes. And I don't know. It's just shocking. It's cool.
Now, Mary, you've said you were inspired by Henry Fortunato, inspired, I think, at least in part.
Absolutely.
Who worked at the Kansas City Public Library for many years and once walked across the state. In fact,
he did.
He's been on this show talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you find Henry's trek so inspiring?
Well, Henry For one thing, what Henry did as someone who was not a native Kansan was come to Kansas and fall in love with it. And to listen to his quest to walk across Kansas and his inspiring words about that was something that really inspired me to take a closer look at our state. And sometimes I think it takes an outsider to point out to you what you have here. And so Henry was very inspiring to me and just a joy to listen to hear his adventures about his walk across the state.
So, Monica, there are 26 of these things, 26 state parks, and you wanted to do, what, couple a month. Was that the right pace, or was it too aggressive, or...
Well, you know, we wanted to start out moderate, but then we kind of had a lot of start, stutter, so that was really kind of more how it happened. And we would do a bunch, and then we'd have, like, life would take us off on another direction, and then we would regather and regroup, and we'd do a bunch, and we just kind of kept doing it until we finished. And we were a little worried towards the end of the year, I have to say.
Because? Worried?
Because we weren't sure we were going to get them all done that year.
Why did you have to get them done in a year?
Because that was the quest for the fun.
That was what the deal was here,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. We had signed that agreement.
Sort of. Kind of. In the air. Verbally.
Has anyone else in the history of Kansas taken on visiting all 26 state parks in a year that you know of?
Not that I know of, but I should.
This might be a history-making voyage here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Quite impressive.
Yay. High five, Mary.
What's your general sense of what kind of park system Kansas has? I mean, is it worth seeing?
It's absolutely worth seeing.
Definitely.
I think that there are a few things that we saw that we'd love to see improved upon. And actually, one of those is knowing where the trails are, if there is a trail in that park, and finding the information to hike it.
I mean, some parks just don't have much to offer in terms of information.
Correct. And we were very lucky to have a book come out by Jonathan and Kristen Conner.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah. Called The Kansas Trails Book, where and they, these two authors from Kansas, researched all the trails in Kansas for biking, hiking, and horseback riding. And about April of 2015, when we did this quest, that book came out and helped us immensely because there were specific directions on how to get to a trailhead and exactly GPS coordinates and wonderful maps. And there were a couple times that book saved us.
in the sense that what?
In the sense that it was unclear sometimes where exactly a trailhead was. It was unclear... I guess what you would see on a trail, and it saved us because we did actually get lost a couple times and run into a few problems, and
the book told us to not do that.
The book told us not to do
and
a couple things.
We didn't believe it.
They said there will be high water at this point, and we thought, no, it's been dry. It'll be fine. We can get through. And there was high water, and we had to turn around and walk back.
That cost us about 5 miles.
Well, do Kansas officials sort of undervalue, underappreciate its own park system? Because you would think at a minimum every state park would have a map and a sense of where the trails are.
It wasn't real clear. And I mean, and we had like problems finding information sometimes on the websites, and I don't know.
And I wouldn't say that Kansas park officials undervalue the state parks.
But if the website isn't that good.
True. But, you know, it takes money to have a good website and to have good maps and good support.
And if the money's not there.
I mean, I think that the park officials do a very good job with what they have. I would love to see more support for the state parks. You know, just in terms of the state park office wasn't even open a few places we went to in the winter time. You know, as far as, you know, having better maps and more information and a better website would be awesome. And I bet they would love it, too. So.
Well, Monica, I think the state parks ought to hire you two as the new ambassadors for the state park system for Kansas, because I can't imagine better ambassadors than the two of you guys.
Yeah, well, we had a great time doing it. And I will say, a few times we emailed, like, the state park people and asked them about the trails, and they were like, gave us prolific amounts of information once we did that. So we did have good luck with that.
Were they aware that you guys were doing what you were doing?
Well, we tried to tell them, but nobody seemed too impressed.
Yeah, exactly.
We were like, guess what we're doing?
Whatever.
They're like, yeah, okay.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Just have fun. Go
two
on.
Two more cranks, yeah. Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking to Mary Gage and Monica Rembolt about their decision to visit all 26 state parks in Kansas a few months ago. So everybody, I'm sure, wants to know, Mary, what was your favorite state park? And did you two agree on what that was?
Oh, boy. You know, there were a couple that were just incredible.
Tell us about them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of them, speaking of Western Kansas, and, you know, you're out there and it's flat and dry and you all of a sudden drive into this little canyon.
Really?
And you have Scott State Park, which is built on a spring. There's a lake. It's just this beautiful little oasis that you
And where
never
in Western
expect.
Kansas is it?
Near Scott City, south of I-70, probably 50, 60 miles. So you're in the very western part of the state.
Right, right.
It takes a little jaunt to get out there.
And
but
you wouldn't expect any place beautiful to be out there,
it
right?
It was an oasis, and with bluffs, and there's the Cuatralejo Pueblo Indian ruins there. It was the most northern spot for Pueblo Indian ruins in the United States. And it's just a beautiful lake with trees and greenery. And there's a path that circumvents the lake, which is kind of fun because it's about 7 miles. It's pretty doable.
Huh.
And so that was great. Wilson Lake.
When you were there, was anybody else there?
Oh, yes.
Okay, there were.
You know,
okay.
That's the thing is once we got to some of these parks, it's an open secret to people who know about the parks.
Oh,
there were people at the parks.
Was that one of your favorites too, Monica?
My favorite was Elk City. And Elk City, we
and
did our...
Where is that exactly? Remind
that
us.
Is in the south.
It's near Independence,
eastern.
Just outside of Independence.
Yeah.
Hey, tell us about it.
It was just, it was our longest hike that we planned on doing. We had a couple other ones that were that length, but not planned. But anyway, it was, we did 9 miles of it, and you walked through, the trail was extremely well marked, and you walked through, the trail went through like these huge boulders that were like the size of houses, and the trail would just meander through in between these two boulders, and then it'd be next to the lake, and then you'd be between more boulders, and it was just, I don't know, it was just so gorgeous, and it was, I think, just the challenge of it, too.
And the name of that park again was?
Elk City State Park.
And coming from you, as someone who's lived in Hawaii, I mean, that's saying something, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Kansas has so many beautiful places, though. I mean, just so many places. You just have to go look at them. I mean, there's just so much to offer if you just get out there and do something. Just go explore.
So this is Elk City State Park. And the first one you mentioned out west, Mary?
Is Scott Lake State Park.
And if our listeners want to call in and offer their recommendations for great state parks in Kansas, we're all ears. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. What else is on your list, Mary?
Absolutely, Wilson Lake. It's quite
Which is where, again? Remind everybody.
Wilson is, it's near Lucas, which is where the Garden of Eden is, out west, kind of close to Hayes area. And Wilson has one of the best mountain bike paths that is pretty famous for mountain bikers because it's a switchback trail. And it's up and down these little hills and right against the shore of the lake. And there's also giant rock spires in another part of the lake. And it's a very clear lake as well. It's just a very stunning lake and really beautiful.
Yeah.
Lots to do at Wilson.
Did you feel rushed as you were trying to get through all 26 in a year? Or were you able to sort of, you know, take a deep breath and enjoy these places when you were there?
Well, a little of both, I would say, because, you know, there were times when we were going toward Western Kansas where we knew we had to do two or three and one time four in a couple days because we, you know, we're doing an overnight. And so, and you know, Kansas is a big state.
Tell me about it.
It really, and you start driving and you think, oh, that'll only take me an hour. And,
Monica, you guys were sort of committed to the idea of hiking, 4 or 5 miles in these different parks once you reach them, right, to really get a sense of the experience.
Yeah, because we also were I mean, in addition to doing the quest, it was also part of our exercise program.
No.
So, I mean, yeah. If we're going to go that far, we wanted to get our money's worth out of it. And plus, we loved seeing all the vistas and, you know, just being outside. And I don't know. It was nice.
Since the trip, have you gone back to some of these places? Have you had a chance to go back?
Well, I have because I do endurance riding on my horse. So we have rides numerous times at state parks. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Mary?
Yeah, sure. I live in Lawrence, so Clinton State Park is nearby, and there's a wonderful trail there called the George Lucas Trail that is actually not within the state park boundaries, but it's a very nice hike. Mm-hmm. So I've been back there. Kaw River State Park is one of our newest state parks. It's in Topeka, and it's our only urban state park. Hmm. It's adjacent to the governor's grounds.
Oh, sure.
And it's along the Kaw River.
Cedar Crest, yeah.
Yes, and it's got wonderful trails.
Mm-hmm. That was a little surprising to find
it
that
really
one
was.
In
yeah.
Topeka. I was like, I can't even believe this was just right here in town.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a nice
park. And it was
park.
Very, uh-huh. you know, country-ish, you know.
You know, tell us about, maybe you've mentioned it, but the Mushroom Rocks at Mushroom Rock State Park.
Oh, yeah, those are great.
That was new to me. Describe those to me.
Well, they actually look like mushrooms made of rock.
That's why they call it Mushroom Rock
State
Park.
They are. They're a rock concretion that's rounded that rests on top another rock concretion that is more like a spire. So they actually do look like mushrooms.
And where is this park located?
And that park is located near Salina and also near Kannapolis State Park.
Yeah, yeah.
So those two parks are right near each other. And Mushroom State Park is actually just a little tiny park where these rock formations are. And so it was our smallest park. Of course, not much of a hike, but we did I think I wrote we took more pictures there per square acre than any other our state park. So,
and you also had a chance, Monica, to sort of get out and see things in the area. Like you went out and saw the largest ball of twine near Glen Elder State Park.
Yeah,
is that worth seeing? I've never seen it.
Well, you know, it
of
is.
Of course it's worth
just like another thing you can check off your list that, yes, I've been there. I mean, who else can brag about having the largest ball of twine in there? But we saw like the
center of the continental United States is right near the Great Ball of Twine.
And Monument Rocks and Castle
Garden
Rock.
Why is there the largest ball of twine? Why do we have that? Why did someone do that? Or do we know that?
Because he wanted to.
Because he wanted to. That's what we're gonna go with.
I think it was a man.
I think we'll go with that.
I mean, you know, it has a building and it probably brings people to that little town. And I don't know.
Actually, it does. We met someone there from Colorado. Remember?
Yeah.
That was traveling. That was one of his stops. It was the big ball of twine. So it is a draw.
At some point, you guys developed this running joke about Meade, Kansas, way down in the southwest part of the state. How is that your running joke? Like, we're almost to Meade?
Okay. Well, when we sat down in January to look at our calendars and decide how we wanted to do this, Monica said, I can't wait to go to Meade. Let's go to Meade first. I'm like, are you kidding? That's 6 hours away. We're not going to
Meade.
And
I did not get what I wanted.
No.
We did it last. So,
it
but
suddenly,
I know she loves me.
It suddenly was November. November, I do. We were like, oh my God, we have to get to Meade. It was a fun trip.
The Dalton Gang's hideout. That was cool.
That's in
really?
Meade.
Yeah.
That is in Meade.
That's in Meade?
Yes.
It's by there.
Is that cool to see?
It was kind of cool.
It actually was.
It was.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's right by Dodge City, so you can see Dodge City. And we stopped through Greensburg, you know, which had been flattened by the tornadoes,
tornado.
Now rebuilt and has all this wonderful new green architecture. And it was
But before you go, tell us about the one big misfire you had where you hiked the trail and then you realized you were missing your keys. Or,
oh, dear. You know, that was early on.
Is that Monica or is that Mary?
Well, it was both.
It was both.
It was more me.
It was more
I
you.
Think.
Okay, yeah.
We were trying to do this thing where you drop a car at one end.
Yes.
And then you travel to the other end in the other car. And that way you only can have to hike one way. You don't have to do a back and forth.
Right.
So we dropped a car, drove to the other end. And
it was a long hike,
It was a long hike. It was longer than we thought, a lot longer than we thought. And we were so excited to see our car. And I said, oh, Monica,
I know. We were like, when are we going to be there? And it just kept going on and on. And then we finally found the car.
And I said, I think I put my keys in my purse, which is in your car at the other end. And we just thought, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
What did you do?
Well, luckily, my daughter was we don't live far from there because it was at Perry Lake. And so I called my daughter and I was like, will you please come? And I just had like barely one signal on my phone. And I was like, can you please come and get us? And I had to try to give her directions. And we were out in this little parking lot somewhere and she found us.
We were saved by a 16-year-old.
You were lucky.
We were lucky.
It sounds like.
We were very lucky.
Tell us the name of that trail book again in case someone listening wants to latch onto that you like so much.
Kansas Trails Guide by Jonathan and Kristen Connard.
Okay.
And it's an excellent, it's really a great source for trails.
Thank me and my horse are on page 89.
Oh, yes, a photo of Monica
right?
made it into the
Is that
photos.
Right? Well, good for you. So bottom line, you'd recommend it to anybody. This is something worth spending some time doing.
It really is, and it's really accessible to mm-hmm. anybody. I mean, the trails are not difficult. You can do as much as or as little as you want. And a lot of this stuff is close to, big cities where people live in Kansas. And
that's great.
It'll surprise you what you'll see and how beautiful the state is.
Well, Mary Gage and Monica Rembolt survived to tell the tale of visiting all 26 state parks in Kansas. They did it a number of months ago, but thank you both for coming in and sharing your story with us. I sure appreciate it. Yeah.
Time for
a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the American military's 1% problem. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, a conversation with the leader of the Grammy-winning Spanish Harlem Orchestra. They're performing in Kansas City this weekend. But first, we'll find out their formula for wowing audiences since 2002. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, America has a 1% problem. That is, the country's relying on less than 1% of its population to maintain security around the globe. And in many places, that force has proven to be far too small. So says Adrian Lewis, one of our guests for this segment, who also says if we had to fight World War II today, we couldn't do it. Now a conversation about our heavy reliance on a small portion of our people to protect us and free people around the globe. With us, Adrian Lewis is the author of The American Culture of War, The History of U.S. Military Force from World War II to Operation Enduring Freedom. He's a professor of history at KU and a retired soldier who served with the U.S. Army's 9th Infantry Division and the 2nd Ranger Battalion. Adrian, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Harvey Sapolsky is a professor of public policy and organization. He recently retired from teaching political science and directing the MIT Security Studies Program. Harvey, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Thank you.
Adrian, I appreciate your point, but I also wanted to point out that 1% of the 323 million people who live in this country is still 3.2 million people. Why isn't that number great enough to keep us safe?
Sometimes it is. It's the issue of war, and can you call upon the American people to serve? So in 2007, 2008, when we were fighting two long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. Army and Marine Corps, the ground forces, were too small to achieve all the objectives that had been established for them. They ended up pulling forces out of Korea. The Strategic Reserve in the United States dropped. We have worldwide responsibilities, and the U.S. Army in Iraq and Afghanistan was simply too small to do everything that was being asked of it.
The fact that we were too small, that really wasn't very well publicized, was it?
No, it wasn't. The armed forces after the Vietnam War, in 1973, we went to the all-volunteer force. And as a consequence of that, the armed forces have become the norm is to not call upon the American people to serve. But if you look back at our history, back to World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, we always started with a small army, but we were always able to call upon the American people to serve. In 1939, when World War II starts, the U.S. Army active force is 180,000 people. couple of years later, it's 6.6 million. That was a function of the draft. When we, if you take a look at Korea, started with fewer than 600,000. 2 years later, they're over 1.5 million there. So we have been able to call upon the American people to serve in times of war. So the argument isn't that you need a draft all the time, but during times of emergencies, during time like two wars, I mean, two long wars going on, we should have been able to call upon the American people to serve, and that's the problem.
Harvey, what's your view here? Is the 1% who protect us too few, in your opinion, too?
There's two ways to look at it. That first, the military is too small for all the obligations, or second, that the obligations are too great for the military.
Which one is it right now?
I think we're overextended needlessly. America is a very secure country. We're mostly defending allies from their neighbors. And this is, I think, not necessary and wasteful of American soldiers. So we have plenty of people in the military. I think the military is large enough, perhaps even too big. And what I would want to do is cut back on the obligations. I think, remember, President Trump recently, he's backed away from all of this, but he talked about our allies doing more. Well, that's, I think, what's needed. We're defending our allies from their neighbors. It's not our security that's at risk. It's theirs. And they should protect themselves and not have American soldiers do their work.
You know, Adrian, you raised this notion of reinstating the draft during times of war, if I heard you right.
That's correct.
You know, do you ever see it coming back? Because a lot of folks might conclude that politically it's simply untenable.
Now, you're right with that. I think the all-volunteer force is sort of become the cultural norm for us now. The armed forces don't establish the missions. That's not their job. Right? So you give them the mission, they try and go at it and do it. So in terms of that, can we achieve the objectives that the political objectives that political civilian leaders have established for us? And in that regard, the armed forces of the United States are too small. In other words, if you look at the commitments around the world, all right, you can make an argument for reducing them, but don't go to the Pentagon and tell them to do that. In other words, you need to go to the White House and tell them that, you know, that's the case.
Yeah. Harvey, can you ever see the draft coming back?
If the United States were in dire straits, yes, but not in the near future, I can't see it.
You know, without it, Harvey, how will this country's leaders ever again connect average Americans with members of the military? I mean, John Kelly, the White House chief of staff and a retired Marine general himself, just bemoaned this lack of a connection. How do we get it back?
I don't buy the 1% argument very much because at 1%, we have 1.3 million in the armed services and another 700 or 800,000 in the reserve. So that's roughly 2 million people that we have in the military. 2%, that's the adult population we're talking about, not the 330 million, but around 200 million people. And if you went to 2%, we'd have to double the military. So we'd have a military of 4 million. If you went to 3%, you'd have another 2 million added on to that. It's not doable. We don't need that kind of military for anything. Mm-hmm. And so we're always going to have a very small percentage. World War II was the exception when we had, 15% of the population in uniform and more than 30% of the adult male population in uniform. That's not going to happen again. And if we did have that kind of ratio, we'd have a 30 million man, 40 million man army. Man and woman army,
right?
This is absurd. So it's always going to be a relatively small population.
So given that, Adrian, do you two disagree here?
Yeah, we do. Let me be clear. Let me be absolutely clear here. It is in times of war. I'm not saying that I need a draft all the time. I'm not saying 1% is fine when you're not in war. But in 2007, 2008, 2009, when we were doing that surge in Iraq and we're trying to secure Afghanistan, at the same time, two extremely long wars.
Halfway around the globe.
That's right. Guys were serving 2, 3, 4 tours. That's just unacceptable. When you have a population size of the United States, to have the burden fall on them. And let me explain this also. the United States could not use its own doctrine. We developed this thing called coin doctrine. All right, you've spent a lot of money and time developing doctrine for the conduct of the war, and then your forces are too small to even use your own doctrine. All right, that's just not acceptable. And if you establish a political objective and then you tell the armed forces to do it, you need to give them the resources to do it. All right?
So the objectives are wrong.
Well, then you can change the objectives, but that's not something the armed forces can do.
We did change the objectives. We moved to a much smaller force in both countries.
Well, let me go back.
And as a consequence of that, if you take a look at Afghanistan right now, the Taliban controls more of it than we do. All right, so did we achieve our political objectives of establishing a stable government there? We've been there for quite a while, and that question is still out there.
You know, one of your concerns, Adrian, is there's this lack of connection between everyday Americans and members of the military. What are the consequences for that?
Now, as you heard, there are two things going on here, and you mentioned General Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And that divorce between the American people and their armed forces,
right.
The lack of cultural
connection.
We don't
want to mess with that. Somebody else's problem now.
That's right. The other part of this thing is the American people themselves in terms of General Brayton, who commands the 35th National Guard Division right here in Kansas in Missouri. Right, he's in the Middle East right now. The division deployed for the first time since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a talk before they deployed. He said 75% of the American people can't serve in the armed forces of the United States. One-third are obese, another third are almost obese, and then another 10 to 15% are on drugs. So he said 75%, and by the way, these figures are known to the Pentagon. Everybody in the armed forces knows that the majority of the American people can no longer serve in the armed forces. So if you eliminate that part of the population, and that leaves you a very small part left in that can be used or can be served in the armed forces. So there is a problem in terms of national security. Can the American people rise to this if the next threat? Right?
Do you think the American people could rise to the next threat, Harvey?
Easily. There's what we do is substitute capital for labor. We substitute weapons for people, and we are casualty averse. We don't want American soldiers or pilots killed, so we use more technology, and we have plenty of technology. So that's the direction we've been going. So our military is going to stay small. It's politically impossible to make it bigger for these kinds of wars, because American's own security really isn't at stake. It's political reasons for doing these things, but they're not enough to mobilize the whole society and put 12 or 15% of the adult population in uniform. It's not worth it, so we don't do it.
Would there be an advantage, Harvey, if more members of the American public were connected somehow, either through the military or even mandatory national service? That would, if more people were connected, the theory might be that we would be less extended overseas in a way that we've just learned about in recent years with our involvements in Iraq and Afghanistan at the same time.
They are connected because we care about the 1% that's in the military. Another 4 or 5% work for the Department of Defense in one way or another, either as direct employees, as civil servants, or as contractors. And they have families, so that doubles at least doubles the percentage of the population that's involved in this. So it's 10 or 15% of the population that has some sort of connection with the military. And the rest of us do care. When a soldier gets killed, it's a serious thing. That's why we substitute capital for labor. That's why we use bigger and bigger weapons or more precise weapons, because we don't want our soldiers killed.
You didn't respond to that.
Yeah, there's just been this sort of dream out there with the armed forces and American people since World War II. For example, air power is going to be the decisive instrument for the conduct of the war. That argument came out in World War II, and then in Korea it was going to be decisive, and then they tried to use it, and then they needed more soldiers on the ground. And then in Vietnam they tried to use the air power. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Army and Marine Corps fought the entire Vietnam War on the strategic defense. The only offensive instrument there was air power. Campaign called Graduated Response. We dropped more bombs on Vietnam than we dropped on the Japanese and the Germans in World War II. twice as many. All right, and we still didn't win the war. All right, so there's this argument, there's this dream out there that air power is going to control the world here, and technology is going to save us. And if that was true, why don't we control Afghanistan? Why don't we control
we
the whole thing?
Because we don't care enough about it.
If air power is going to be the decisive instrument for the conduct of war, if it's going to, you know, win everything, then why don't we just use air power?
Yeah.
I mean,
it has never proven decisive in any war.
Harvey, hop in here.
I'm saying it doesn't. We don't care enough about it. We cared enough about winning World War II, and we were running out of soldiers at the end of World War II. We were trying to move soldiers from Europe to fight into the Pacific, and they didn't want to go. Most people, you know, have their limits about how much service they were willing to give. Even in that war, we had a bomb that ended the war, and if we really cared enough about Afghanistan, we could win, but we don't care. It's 8,000 miles from here.
Yeah.
I suppose we could nuke Afghanistan, but
we could have enough soldiers if we cared.
I wouldn't recommend that, but
yeah. We don't care. It's not our security, really, that's at risk.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Interesting conversation it is. Harvey Sapolsky, you just heard his voice, professor of public policy and organization, recently retired from teaching poli-sci and directing the MIT Security Studies Program. Harvey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Adrian Lewis is the author of The American Culture of War, The History of U.S. Military Force from World War II to Operation Enduring Freedom. Adrian, so good to have you, too. Appreciate
it. Happy to be here.
Okay, what can Missouri do about providing affordable, quality health care for all of its citizens? That's a question in this week's episode of KCUR's political podcast, State House Blend, Missouri.
From KCUR Studios, this is State House Blend, Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. Few issues have occupied as prominent and contentious a spot on the national political stage over the last decade as health care. It's a political hot button in every state. That's especially true in Missouri. So what happens with all that politics in Missouri? What's the reality that Missourians are facing? Today, State House Blend Missouri takes a deep dive into health care and what can and should be done. We recorded this episode live in Kansas City's Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church.
Joining us are Representative Lauren Arthur. She's a Democrat from Kansas City North, and the ranking Democrat on the House Health and Mental Health Policy Committee. Representative Arthur, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. And Senator Ryan Silvey, he's a Republican from Kansas City North, a member of the Senate Health and Pension Committee. Welcome to you, Senator Silvey.
Thank you for having me.
And also the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard. He's pastor at St. Mark Union Church here in Kansas City and president of the Greater Kansas City Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He's been actively engaged on this issue for a long time. Welcome to you, Dr. Howard.
Brian, thank you.
And I want to start with you, Dr. Howard. You were among the Medicaid 23, as they are sometimes called. They were 23 folks who were arrested in the Senate gallery about 3 years ago, demonstrating for Medicaid expansion. That was more than 3 years ago, but in some ways, not much has changed. Missouri remains one of 19 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. How important is expanding Medicaid in Missouri?
Still remains extremely important. You are correct. 23 clergy persons, including myself, were arrested for engaging in peaceful, nonviolent, direct action, civil disobedience. It was in May of 2014. It was some 4 years after the signing into law of the ACA, as we know, Obamacare. And during that four-year period, the state legislature had refused to receive those funds to aid and assist, particularly poor people and working poor who could not afford the same quality of health care that legislators themselves or that professionals in the broader community do enjoy. And so in May of 2014, it was just prior to the ending of the session. As clergy persons, we felt it a moral responsibility for us to elevate and escalate the issue of the lack of, I believe, justice and equity with respect to the provision of health care. And that was based on a principle. We believe that adequate health care and equal access to health care should not be a privilege for some, but a right for all. And that is a moral principle that we embrace and is the reason why we were willing to engage in civil disobedience then, and we continue to advocate for it now.
Senator Silvey, the Senate didn't vote to expand Medicaid. That's unlikely to happen in the current environment in Jefferson City. Why is that? Why is Medicaid expansion something that that legislators in Missouri have not been supportive of?
You know, I think it's a couple things. I think politics, first and foremost. You know, during that time in 2014, I actually had a plan to expand Medicaid, which was the only Republican proposal to do so. Politics is what killed it. But also education.
Can you say more about that? What? How did politics kill it? What's politically unsavory about providing more health care, as Dr. Howard would say?
Sure. So, I mean, look, we live in a day of sound bites, right? I mean, we govern by sound bites, unfortunately, in a lot of places. And really what it had come down to was President Obama was not popular in the state of Missouri. Not that he wasn't popular in certain places in Missouri, but statewide he was not popular. And the proposal was branded Obamacare, and it was not popular. So you had a bunch of people in my party that just wouldn't touch it.
Let me ask Representative Arthur, you were not in the legislature at that time, and yet you're now part of a Democratic caucus that in theory supports expanding Medicaid but doesn't really have the votes to accomplish that. Do you share Dr. Howard's view that this is a matter of sort of basic rights, that people should have health care as a basic human privilege?
I completely agree with that. That's actually the first thing I wanted to say, is that I believe that affordable health care is a basic human right. And I think most Americans agree with that now. In terms of it playing out as a reality in Missouri, I'm not sure that that's always the case. We still have hundreds of thousands of people who are uninsured. We have hundreds of thousands of people who are underinsured, which basically means that maybe you have insurance, but you can't afford the actual health care. And the number one reason that people file for bankruptcy, any guesses? Medical debt. And so it's a real problem.
Dr. Howard, you were trying to jump in there.
I was. I think that Mr. Silvey's comments were correct in terms of the political analysis, and President Obama, then President Obama, being unpopular at the time. I would say, and not go far into the weeds about why he was unpopular, because there are racial undertones that are underneath that unpopularity, if you will. Broader, though, motivating the legislature, it is my opinion, is that there is this kind of callousness and a kind of mercilessness, if you will, with respect to policy in the state of Missouri and broader in the nation with respect to economic issues and wellness of poor people.
Let me ask Senator Silvey about that, and I'm not asking you to defend the position of colleagues that you actually disagree with on this issue, but
thank you for that.
and I understand that, but I mean, you also are our colleagues and friends with these folks. Is it callousness? Is it a disregard for human welfare? Or what is the legitimate policy position at stake here?
So I started off with saying it was politics and lack of education, and I think, in my opinion, you know, working with these folks, it's the lack of education that leads to the perception of callousness. Rural Republicans dominate right now. From a numeric standpoint, they dominate. But in many of their districts, it is they have some of the poorest districts in the state where some of the most people are on these programs. So I'm not sure why there's a disconnect there, but they don't seem to quite grasp that or understand that.
Other questions from our audience?
My name is Lynn, and I'm from Chillicothe in Livingston County, so I'm probably the lone rural person here. It pains me to see the urban-rural divide that I think rural Missouri creates. I don't think urban Missouri is creating that.
I agree that Democrats had abandoned rural areas for a long time, and we now recognize how devastating that's been, not just to us as a party, but to the state of Missouri.
Senator Sylvie, when there have been bipartisan things happening in the General Assembly the last few years, you've often been part of them as a Republican. How do you build coalitions around issues that are not necessarily a partisan concern? What makes that work?
Sure. Senator Bond has been a real mentor to me. He was the first person that I worked for out of college, and he told me that nobody has a monopoly on solutions, okay? No person, no party, nobody. So when it comes to building those coalitions, you just have to, first of all, be willing to talk to people.
It is easier to have these kinds of victories in a city where persons are working together in the same place, living together in the same neighborhoods, traveling within the same infrastructure, of different races, of different class, of different social orientation. When we get to some of the rural areas, there is such isolation sometimes. There is such lack of exposure socially to anyone else that is different than what you may be. I don't know how to get around that. I do know, though, that there is hope for America. And we're going to see that what is really underneath the American foundations is the love and brotherhood and sisterhood and economic parity that we long for. And I believe this is the last ditch effort of that opposition that does not want us to see us come together as a country. We are on our way. We need to hold out. We need to hold on. Embrace the principles of fairness, of democracy, of voting enfranchisement, not disenfranchisement. And we're going to see that just beyond the horizon, there's America that's going to rise up, and we're going to embrace these principles. I believe that with all of my heart.
I want to thank our guests, invite you to thank Representative Lauren Arthur, Democrat, Senator Ryan Sylvie, a Republican, and Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
This episode was recorded live on November 30th at Kansas City's Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church. We had help this week from Mike Russo, Chris Young, and Ron Jones. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you next time.
You can hear the entire episode at kcur.org, and don't forget to subscribe to State House Blend Missouri on NPR1 or wherever you get your podcasts. Our podcasts and previous programs are at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's program, a conversation with the founder of the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. We'll chat about their upcoming performance in Kansas City and the journey to becoming Grammy winners. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.